So that's called a bitter motivation. So as we know, when we are motivated by only the attachment to the happiness of this life, then our actions are not Dharma actions. We aren't necessarily creating non-virtue, but we're not having a Dharma action. So Dharma actions are based on a more expansive mind that really accepts the Buddhist worldview and that believes that there are future rebirths and wants to attain a fortunate one, a Buddhist worldview that believes we can become liberated from samsara by generating wisdom and wants to do that. And a Buddhist worldview that believes that we are not innately self-centered, but that we can really open our hearts and cherish others as much as, if not more than, we cherish ourselves. So having a Dharma motivation, or at least not a non-virtuous motivation, is the real key to creating good karma and to being happy right now as well. So let's stretch our mind and really think of our human potential, our inner human beauty, what we can become if we really use the potential that we have. And in that way, aspire for full awakening for the benefit of all beings, knowing that at full awakening, we fulfill our own aspirations for complete abandonment of negativities and realization of all good qualities. And we also fulfill the aim of others because we will be able to manifest in various ways to be of service and benefit to them. So in this way, in practicing the Dharma, we don't neglect ourselves, but we really think deeply about what is our ultimate aim and purpose, and what is our potential, and what can we offer to the world. And then we go about creating the causes for that. So Geshe Thakke, yesterday or the day before, when he was talking about the importance of having a Buddhist worldview and why it's so difficult for us to think of future lives and have conviction in that, he noted that it has a lot to do with having a body, and that the sensations of having a body are so real and so strong, that they kind of consume all of our energy and our thought, so that our motivation very easily slides into wanting the happiness of only this life, which focuses a lot around the happiness of this body. Yeah. I noticed that, they don't always talk about the happiness. They talk about reputation and image and things like that, but they seem to really emphasize so much the physical happiness. And I wonder if, because in ancient cultures, the physical suffering was much more in many ways than what we have now. Whereas now, image, reputation, approval, praise, for many people are more at the forefront of what they're craving than physical comfort. Not for everybody, but for some people. So it makes me wonder if that's at work there. But in any case, the appearance of this life is so real that it's really hard for us to think that there's anything else but it, and that we can be anything else but who we are now, even though in this very life we have not been always who we are now, and we will not be always who we are now. Yeah, it's hard to believe that we were a 3-day-old baby. Yeah. And yet we know that we didn't come out of Mama's womb this big. Poor Mama, if we did. Okay. So it's interesting, isn't it, how we know that once we were infants who couldn't think clearly and couldn't even put the pieces of our sensual perceptions together to make an object. And yet, it's hard to believe that we really were like that. Yeah. So I think this whole thing of really thinking about the Buddhist worldview and making it our own is really a key thing to practice. Otherwise, saying everything else is just words, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, I generate bodhicitta for the benefit of all sentient beings so that they all may be free from samsara. But I don't really believe in samsara. So what in the world am I motivating for? Yeah. And I don't really believe that we can cherish others more than ourselves. So what am I really thinking? You know, I'm just saying the words. So I think this is why, you know, getting familiar with the Buddhist worldview and, you know, which we do through the Lamrim meditations, through the analytic meditations. Yeah, we don't get the Buddhist worldview from doing tantric visualizations. And we don't get it from doing serenity meditation. Yeah, it's from doing Lamrim. Okay, so we're coming back to debate, yeah, which maybe we're a little bit more invigorated for because we see from Geshe Thapke's teachings that there's actually some usages for it and that it's very important. So I wanted to go back and review again, okay, because we're talking about the possible answers that, you know, after that there's 5 different answers that a defender can give and how the debate can go from there, okay? So the first one was after the defender says why, okay? And so remember, when the defender says why, it really means no, okay? So the example, where did it go, that he gave in here, yeah, was it's starting kind of in the middle with the defender saying, I accept that whatever is a valid cognizer is necessarily a direct perceiver. And then the challenger says, then it follows that the subject, an inferential cognizer, realizing sound as an impermanent phenomena by the sign of being a product, is a direct perceiver. Okay. Is it a direct perceiver? Is an inferential cognizer a direct perceiver? No. Okay, so what the challenger is saying isn't correct. And so the defender notices that and says, why? And then the challenger says, well, because it's a valid cognizer, because you asserted that whatever is a valid cognizer is necessarily a direct perceiver. So you just said that that inferential mind, knowing sound is impermanent, we know it's an inference, yeah. But you just said, and we know it's a valid mind, but you just said if it's a valid mind, direct perceiver, so it must be. So why isn't it a direct perceiver? Conceptual. It's a conceptual consciousness. So what does a conceptual consciousness do that that a direct perceiver doesn't? Yeah, it knows its object by means of a conceptual appearance. Okay. So I have another one here. Yeah. So let's say the defender starts out. The defender says, we don't know what the challenger says, but the defender says, I accept that whoever has great compassion has necessarily realized emptiness. Okay. So what are you going to say to that? We start out like that, you know. So the defender says, I accept that whoever has great compassion has necessarily realized emptiness. And the challenger says, then it follows that the subject, a bodhisattva on the path of accumulation, has necessarily realized emptiness. And what does the defender say? Why? And so what does the challenger say in response to that?
Because of someone who has generated great compassion, you asserted the pervasion.
Okay. And then what happens? Is it true that a bodhisattva on the path of accumulation has realized emptiness? Not necessarily. So what are you going to do then, you know? So the defender said, I accept that whoever has great compassion has necessarily realized emptiness. And then the challenger says, it follows that a bodhisattva on the path of accumulation has realized emptiness. And the defender says, that's not right. So the challenger says, well, you asserted that whoever has great compassion has realized emptiness, and the bodhisattva on the path of accumulation has great compassion, so I must have realized emptiness. Yeah, and then where are you going to take the argument from there?
Hopefully at that point the defender would say, I'm wrong, I made a mistake. And it's the challenger who's driving this, so it'd be interesting to see where the challenger takes it next.
Yeah, so what is a syllogism that the challenger could make to show that that whoever has great compassion has not necessarily realized emptiness? I mean, how would you explain that to somebody? Why not? Let's forget debate language for a minute, okay? If somebody comes up to you, you know, in a Q&A session and says, okay, well, whoever has great compassion has realized emptiness, Yeah. Then what are you going to say? You're in a discussion group and somebody says, yeah, well, they've realized emptiness, haven't they, if they have great compassion. What's the right view that you want to come to, that you want to explain to that person?
You would explain that not necessarily, that having great compassion is not an indication of having realized emptiness, but having great compassion is the cause that leads to bodhicitta. And the realization of bodhicitta is the entry to the path of accumulation. Mm-hmm. However, a bodhisattva does not realize emptiness necessarily until that bodhisattva has achieved the path of seeing. No, the path of inferentially the path of preparation.
You really? What about a sharp faculty bodhisattva?
Necessarily, I said. Necessarily. So it is possible. Mm-hmm. That a bodhisattva could realize inferentially emptiness before the path of accumulation. And in fact, a sharp faculty bodhisattva would pursue that route. Mm-hmm. But it is not necessarily so, as you stated, that a person who has great compassion necessarily has realized emptiness.
I think it would be possible to ask for the challenger to ask the defender, how do the two compare? A bodhisattva who's realized emptiness and a person who has generated great compassion.
Yeah, that's a good way to pursue it. So, yeah, okay, so you be the challenger and you ask Venerable Tsepel that.
Where he's going, but how do the two compare? A bodhisattva who's realized emptiness and a person who's realized great compassion.
I think there's four possibilities. Mm-hmm. So something is that's both person who's realized emptiness and generated great compassion would be, for instance, a bodhisattva on the path of seeing. They necessarily have, okay, and then someone who has a bodhisattva who has, it's hard to hang on to these, I didn't write them down. Bodhisattva who has realized emptiness, but does not have, oh, 3P. There's no bodhisattva who has realized emptiness who doesn't have great compassion. Yeah. But there would be a person who has generated great compassion who's not necessarily a bodhisattva, someone who hasn't fully developed spontaneous bodhicitta. They might have realized great compassion, but not yet gone the next step to generate uncontrived or spontaneous bodhicitta. And certainly there's someone who's neither, like me.
So actually what's coming out here is there's a lot of things we need to clarify. Who's realized emptiness inferentially and directly? Yeah. Who's realized great compassion? To realize bodhicitta, do you need to have realized great compassion? If you have realized great compassion, have you necessarily generated bodhicitta?
I think you have to not bring in bodhicitta because now you're adding another thing and you can only compare two things. But you do have to understand that you could have great compassion and not have bodhicitta in order to answer that, not get muddled.
Yeah, but the way bodhicitta came in was because she started to say that a bodhisattva, what did you start to say? A bodhisattva who has realized emptiness but doesn't have great compassion, you know? Yeah, so you wanted to say a person who has realized emptiness who does not have great compassion. Wait, let's what's the comparison again? Let's start over.
Between a bodhisattva who's realized emptiness and a person who's realized great compassion. That was my question. How do those two compare?
Okay.
You can write it on the board. Safa, who has realized emptiness, and we should probably define that, whether it's
no, just leave it as realized emptiness.
Okay.
Because that will.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the other one was a person who has realized great compassion.
Person who has great compassion. Yeah. Okay, so who has both?
Bodhisattva on the path of seeing necessarily has realized emptiness directly and has great compassion because they're a bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. Bodhisattva on the path of seeing.
Okay. What about a bodhisattva on the path of preparation? What about a bodhisattva on the path of accumulation?
A sharp faculty bodhisattva on the path of accumulation would also have realized emptiness conceptually and or inferentially, and would have great compassion.
We don't have to distinguish it here, but we can. Yeah, just put PA.
Where would they be on the path of accumulation if they've realized emptiness?
Why? Because sharp faculty bodhisattvas realize emptiness inferentially before entering the path.
Yeah, I get that, but if they're a bodhisattva and they've realized emptiness, if they're a bodhisattva, they have bodhicitta, right?
Yes.
Because you said a sharp faculty bodhisattva. And if they're a sharp faculty bodhisattva and you're saying they're both, you're also saying that they've realized emptiness. So already that puts them on...
Where? A sharp faculty bodhisattva,
right.
A sharp faculty person has
realized...
Oh, you
said bodhisattva up there.
Yeah, but a sharp faculty bodhisattva, that means they're on the path of accumulation at least.
Right.
Yeah, they've realized emptiness, and they also inferentially...
Right. I guess maybe I don't understand the path of preparation well enough.
Okay. The path of preparation, the demarcation, this is the advantage of doing debate, is it brings out these things. The path, demarcation for entering the path of a preparation is you have the union of serenity and insight on emptiness, and that's an inferential realization.
Don't have meditative stabilization?
You do. So you can realize emptiness without having the unity of serenity and insight on emptiness. Yeah, because you can realize emptiness inferentially even before you enter the path of accumulation. Okay? A sharp faculty person realizes emptiness before they even enter the path, but they don't have a unity of serenity and insight on emptiness.
What I don't quite understand, I guess, is can anyone, whether a bodhisattva or not, have an inferential realization of emptiness without having generated serenity?
Yes.
Good.
Question is, we're talking about great compassion, we're not talking about bodhicitta. Is the sharp faculty bodhisattva on the path of accumulation if they don't have uncontrived bodhicitta, if they only have great compassion?
But still a sharp faculty bodhisattva has great compassion. A sharp faculty bodhisattva on the path of accumulation, do they have great compassion?
Okay.
Yes. To be a bodhisattva, you have to have bodhicitta.
Yeah. Both. Okay. What's
okay. So, but label the top one A and the bottom one B.
Could there be a bodhisattva on the path of accumulation, or even a person who's realized emptiness inferentially and has serenity, but hasn't got the union.
Yes.
So they're training on the path of accumulation to get to that point.
Right. Because just having the inferential understanding doesn't mean you have serenity, and just having serenity doesn't mean you have the inferential understanding of emptiness. To enter the path of preparation, you have to have the unity of serenity and insight on emptiness, not on impermanence or something else, but on emptiness. Okay, so then we have both. What is A bodhisattva who's realized emptiness, but not B, a person who has great compassion?
And any person who fits that.
Okay. Why?
bodhisattva who has realized emptiness is necessarily developed uncontrived or spontaneous bodhicitta, and so they necessarily have great compassion in their continuum.
Okay. What about if we changed A to a person who has realized emptiness? Don't erase it. But if we change it to a person who has realized emptiness and a person who has great compassion.
Then you could say someone like a hearer Arya.
Mm-hmm.
On the path of seeing or path of meditation.
Uh-huh. Has?
Has realized emptiness, but does not necessarily have great compassion as defined by Jason Kappa.
Yeah. Okay.
So for this, what we have here, there isn't any.
No. Okay, so just X. Okay, then what is B but not A?
Person who has great compassion but is not a bodhisattva who has realized emptiness could be a person who has realized great compassion who has not entered the path,
mm-hmm,
and has not realized emptiness. That's kind of wordy. So maybe...
Yeah.
You could say, what are we saying besides dull faculties?
Modest faculty.
A modest faculty bodhisattva on the path of accumulation who has not yet realized emptiness.
Modest faculty bodhisattva on
path of accumulation.
Just PA. Okay. Yeah.
Who has not yet realized emptiness. And neither is Tenzin Sepple.
Okay. So, good. So that was one way to take it, and then to ask for a comparison of those phenomena, and then you wind up getting a lot clearer. Yeah? Another way that you could take it is the challenger says, you know, it follows that an arya. How did we have it? Where the defender says, "I accept that whoever has great compassion has necessarily realized emptiness." Okay, and then the challenger says, "It follows that an arya bodhisattva has realized emptiness directly," or it just starts out. The challenger says. Okay, an Arya Bodhisattva has realized emptiness directly. And the defender says, why? Because they don't believe it. And then the challenger says, then it follows that an Arya Bodhisattva has not realized emptiness directly. Yeah. And to that, the defender says, I accept it. And then the challenger says, give a reason why an Arya Bodhisattva has not realized emptiness directly. Or the challenger could say, it follows an Arya. Okay, so this is when the defender accepts something that's incorrect, there's two ways you can go. One way is to ask them for a reason that validates what they just said. And the other is to explain to them how it actually is, which in this case would be, it follows an Arya Bodhisattva has realized emptiness directly because there are Arya Bodhisattvas on the path of seeing meditation and no more learning. Yeah, or you could say it follows that Arya Bodhisattvas have realized emptiness directly because they have a union of serenity and insight focused non-conceptually on emptiness. Okay. So what we're talking about here is, you know, that we're giving an example of after the defender says no, how you can take the debate. Just making some sense to you?
Yeah, I didn't hear it correctly, but it would seem like to begin with, it follows, then we're giving them a consequence that would show their wrong thinking, not try to show what's right.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I mean?
Yes.
So more like, so then it follows that mm-hmm. a bodhisattva on the paths of seeing meditation mm-hmm. and no more learning has not realized emptiness because of what you just said.
No, on this one, the challenger doesn't always have to start out with something that's incorrect. Yeah, so here the challenger is starting out with something that's correct, saying, you know, an Arya Bodhisattva has realized emptiness directly. Yeah, and the defender says, why? Yeah. So then, because the defender is doubting it, then the challenger comes back and says, it follows that an Arya Bodhisattva has not realized emptiness directly, which is what was implied by the defender's answer. And so the defender says, I accept it. And then the challenger says, give a reason why an Arya Bodhisattva has not realized emptiness directly. Another, okay, so then he puts it back in the court of the defender. And what's the defender going to say at that moment? Oops, exactly. Okay. Yeah. Or another way the debate could have gone is after the challenger said, then it follows that an Arya Bodhisattva has not realized emptiness directly, and the defender says yes. Then another way the challenger could come back is to say, it follows Arya Bodhisattvas have realized emptiness because an Arya Bodhisattva on the path of seeing has the union of serenity and insight focused non-conceptually on emptiness. And so proving that point. Okay? There's two ways it can go. Either asking the defender to justify their point or explain or giving them an example of what contradicts their assertion.
The consequence, the challenger could come back after that, the defender accepted and say, oh, so then it follows that a bodhisattva on the paths of seeing mm-hmm. preparation, meditation and no more learning is not an Arya Bodhisattva it's not an Arya Bodhisattva.
Yeah, you could say that. Well, no, because you're talking about Arya Bodhisattvas if they've realized emptiness. So you would have to say it follows that
have not realized emptiness, those three.
Yeah, you would have to say, so the challenger said, then it follows that an Arya Bodhisattva has not realized emptiness directly. Okay. And so then you want to say what? Well, the defender has said that, so you want to prove the defender wrong. So what do you want to say? Well, that's one way to say it. Give a reason why the Arya Bodhisattva has not realized emptiness directly. Or you say, you know, there are Arya Bodhisattvas who have realized emptiness directly, and then you give an example of someone who has. Okay. Yeah.
Also, you could bring in the definition of Arya. Mm-hmm. You could say, so it follows that the definition of Arya is not a being who has realized emptiness directly and non-conceptually. That would mm-hmm. depend on both of you knowing the definition.
Yeah, and then the guy may say, yeah, that's true. And you say, what do you say? You dum-dum?
Or you could just ask them the definition of the of uh-huh. Arya.
No, then you come back and you give the proper definition. Yeah. Okay. So that's when the defender says why. Then the next one is after the defender says the reason is not established. So here, again, he's kind of starting in the middle. But he says, the key is when the defender questions the establishment of the reason, the predominant response from the challenger is to give them another reason justifying the earlier one. Okay? So here's the one we got stuck on last time. So the defender says, I accept that whatever is a color is necessarily red, because the challenger started out the debate saying, you know, whatever is a color is necessarily red. And the defender said, I accept it. Okay? And then the challenger says, it follows that whatever is a color is necessarily red, repeated what he said, and the defender says, I accept it. And then the challenger says, then it would follow that the subject, the color of a white conch, is red. Yeah? And then the defender, he's getting a little smarter at this point, and he says, why? In other words, no. And then the challenger says, well, because of being a color. And you asserted that the pervasion, that whatever is a color is necessarily red. Because of being a color, you asserted the pervasion, that whatever is a color is necessarily red. Okay? And so then the defender said, the reason that the color of a white conch is a color is not established. Okay. And then the challenger says, it follows that the subject, the color of a white conch, is a color because of being white. Okay. So remember, this had the thing where you had to prove, you had to divert for a moment and prove the reason is a quality of the subject. Yeah. Okay. And so that's when you had to take the predicate of the previous one and make it the thesis of the one you're now doing, and then coming up with another reason. Okay. Yeah, the reason of the previous one, you know, which was is a cut. Wait a minute. Yeah, you take the subject and you have to show that the subject is the reason. Okay. Yeah, so you have to give another kind of thing where what was the reason now becomes the predicate. Okay, so then you have that little diagram. I think that's where we stopped last time. Okay. So you can see in the diagram, you know, somebody said it follows the subject is red because of being a color. So the subject, the conch, that follows that the white conch is red because of being a color. Yeah. So then you have to change it and say it follows that the white conch is a color because of being white. What? It follows that the color of the white conch is a color because of being white. Okay, because the guy didn't really believe that before. Okay, then he gives another one here. Okay, where the challenger says, it follows that the subject, uncomposed space, is a hidden phenomena because of being a conventional truth. Okay, so what's the defender going to say to that? First, the defender has to check if the reason applies to the subject. So what is that person going to check? That holds, doesn't it? Okay, then the defender says, the reason that uncomposed space is a conventional truth is not established. So the defender doesn't realize that what the challenger said was correct. And no, it has nothing. We're thinking we're Satantrikas now.
Oh, no, that's what...
Okay. So the defender says the reason that uncomposed space is a conventional truth is not established. So then the challenger comes back, you know, and then they have to establish why uncomposed space is a conventional truth. So they say it follows that the subject, uncomposed space, is not a conventional truth, which is the opposite of what's true. And the defender says, I accept it. So the defender hasn't realized their mistake yet. So then the challenger says, give a reason justifying that the subject uncomposed space is not a conventional truth. And what are they going to say? Yeah, I don't have a reason. Okay, so here's another thing that I made up. We'll see if it works. Okay, so the defender says, I accept that whoever is a bodhisattva is necessarily an Arya bodhisattva. So the challenger just repeats that back. It follows that whoever is a bodhisattva is necessarily an Arya bodhisattva. And the defender says, I accept that whoever is a bodhisattva is necessarily an Arya bodhisattva. That's the defender said that. The challenger repeated it back to them. Yeah, and then the defender said, I agree, because that's what the defender thinks. Then, okay. So is that true? Is the reason established in the subject? Yeah, what's confusing here is they don't always give a whole consequence or a syllogism, you know. They often just give parts of it. Because, because we're just having, it follows that whoever is a bodhisattva is necessarily an Arya bodhisattva. Defender says, I accept. Okay. Then the challenger says, so what does the challenger have to do at this point? The defender has a wrong idea. So what is it that the challenger has to help the defender understand? Yeah, but wait, what is it they have to get? What's the right conclusion that they have to get? They want the defender to understand. Yeah, that whoever is a bodhisattva is not necessarily an Arya bodhisattva. Okay. So one way they can do that is by saying something incorrect and hoping that giving a wrong consequence. For example, the challenger could say, oh, well, then it would follow that a bodhisattva on the path of preparation is an Arya bodhisattva. Yeah, because of being bodhisattva. Yeah, and the defender says, why? And then the challenger says, because of being a bodhisattva, you asserted the pervasion that whoever is a bodhisattva is necessarily an Arya bodhisattva. Okay, but then the defender goes back and says, the reason that a bodhisattva on the path of preparation is a bodhisattva isn't established. Yeah, this guy's really dense, okay? Yeah?
It's not a bodhisattva.
It is a bodhisattva. It's an established. Okay, well, you're calling them a bodhisattva, but, you know. So, yeah. The defender says the reason that a bodhisattva on the path of preparation is a bodhisattva isn't established. Okay, so then the challenger has to change, and they can, one, ask for a point, you know, ask them to give an example. Okay, so the challenger could say, okay, then, you know, or give a, you know, justify why you said that a bodhisattva on the path of preparation isn't necessarily a bodhisattva. Why are you saying that? Yeah, give a reason why the bodhisattva on the path of preparation isn't a bodhisattva. So that's one way the challenger can take it. Okay, because the defender is making an erroneous statement. Yeah, so the challenger says, okay, defend your wrong, what you just said. Or another way that the challenger could do it is then they need to prove that whoever is a bodhisattva isn't necessarily an Arya bodhisattva. No, they need at this point to prove that whoever is a bodhisattva on the path of preparation is a bodhisattva, because that's what the defender said isn't established. So they say, it follows a bodhisattva on the path of preparation is a bodhisattva because of having undegenerated, uncontrived bodhicitta. Yeah. Okay, so what we're coming to here is, again, the same two things, that the defender said something wrong. So the challenger can either say, justify what you did say, what you just said, give a reason or give an example for that, or the challenger can go back and make a correct syllogism, which in this case would be, yeah, the subject of bodhisattva on the path of preparation is a bodhisattva because of having undegenerated, uncontrived bodhicitta. Okay, are you getting this? You have to go over the examples in the book a lot. And I tried to make up some examples here that were a little bit different than the book ones to get you thinking about some other topics.
So then how do you get back to the first statement, you know, about whoever is a bodhisattva is an Arya bodhisattva, because it's gone off in a different direction?
Yeah, because you had to prove that first the path of preparation bodhisattva is a bodhisattva, but then you would go back and say, you know, the prep, you know, the subject, a bodhisattva on the path of preparation is not an Arya bodhisattva because of not having realized emptiness directly. But then the guy saying, well, you know, maybe he didn't realize emptiness directly, but he could still be an Arya bodhisattva. So the guy may be really confused and may say, yeah.
I'm curious if you would necessarily need that word whose bodhicitta hasn't degenerated, because I thought bodhicitta didn't degenerate past the first level of the
past
path.
Past the middle one. It can
of the path of accumulation.
Yeah, it
and
can.
And this is a bodhisattva on the path of preparation.
No,
I thought you said.
Right, yes, I did say. Okay. No, undegenerated, uncontrived. Yeah, okay. Sorry. Yeah, we don't need the undegenerated part. For the path of preparation, yeah. And so then you come back to whoever is a bodhisattva is not necessarily an Arya bodhisattva, which was, then you say, tsa! Yeah?
Who made the first statement? It follows whoever is a bodhisattva is an Arya bodhisattva.
The defender, and then the challenger repeated it. But, you know, here he's like starting in the middle of a debate, So maybe you could start the debate by the challenger just saying, it follows whoever is a bodhisattva is necessarily an Arya bodhisattva. You could probably start like that too. It seems rather difficult and complicated. Yeah, because we would just ask a question, you know, if you're a bodhisattva, are you necessarily an Arya bodhisattva? We would ask the question. But maybe we have the person who answers the question answers it incorrectly and says, yeah, that's true. If you're a bodhisattva, you must be an Arya bodhisattva. But then you've heard something, you know, from somebody else that you have some doubt about it. So then you ask again, yeah? I mean, in English debate, is that somebody would say, yeah, that's true. If you're a bodhisattva, you're necessarily an Arya bodhisattva. And then you, being a very polite person, wouldn't argue back. You would just nod your head, write it down in your notebook, and believe it because somebody else said it. Or maybe you would not really believe it and put a question mark and then go ask somebody else another time who might say, oh, no, if you're a bodhisattva, you aren't necessarily an Arya bodhisattva. So then you have that answer. But do you understand why? Yeah, if somebody just says, yeah, if you're a bodhisattva, you're not necessarily an Arya bodhisattva. Do you understand why? You have the right answer, but you don't have a clue as to why. Yeah, so I think this is where debate can be helpful, is because you have to explain why you believe something. Yeah, because you can say something and then the defendant just goes, why? I don't accept that, you know? So we need to do a lot of practice to get the sense of this, okay? I made up some new things. Maybe we should stick with the same old ones, but I don't know. I think it's
these are more relevant.
Yeah, it gets us. Yeah, you know, debating the color of a white conch is, you know, it doesn't really grab me. Okay, so then the third thing that a defender could say is there is no privation. So now, after the defender says there's no privation. Okay. So he says in the book, when the defender answers that there's no privation, as in the other cases, the challenger may go on to justify why the privation was put forth, or the challenger may ask the defender to justify why he or she gave that answer. So these two choices come all the time, so it's important to remember them. That either you ask the defender to justify what they said, or you give them an example that contradicts what they said. Okay? You can string them on a little bit, you know, by looking like you agree with them until you get them to a point where they say, why? Like, you know, come on. Okay, so in the book, yeah, it starts out, the challenger says, it follows that the subject, uncomposed space, is not a product because of being a conventional truth. Okay? So start out looking at that. Yeah, what do you think about that? Follows that the subject, uncomposed space, is not a product because of being a conventional truth. So what's the first thing that you check? Yeah, so is the property of the subject here? Yes. What's the second thing you check? Privation. Is there forward privation? What would the forward privation be here? Okay, if it's a conventional truth, it's necessarily not a product. Is that correct? Okay, Good. So what the challenger is saying is true. But the defender says there's no pervasion. Okay? Meaning that it's not the case that whatever is a conventional truth is necessarily not a product. So then the challenger says, it follows that whatever is a conventional truth is necessarily not a product, because a common locus of the two, product and conventional truth, does not exist. Okay, so the challenger is coming back and giving a reason why there is pervasion, why whatever is a conventional truth is necessarily not a product. Okay. And to do that, whatever is a conventional truth is necessarily not a product, because a common locus of the two, product and conventional truth, does not exist. Is that true, that there's a common, that there's no common locus between product and conventional truth in this system? That's true. Okay. So when he says in the book, when the defender gives the answer that there is no privation, the other way the challenger can go is to try and get the defender to justify the answer. So in that example we just gave, the challenger came back and gave the correct answer. Okay? And then the defender hopefully accepts it. Okay? Another way the challenger could have come back is to say it follows that the subject, uncomposed space, is not a product because of being a conventional truth. In other words, just repeating that again. The defender says there's no privation. And then the challenger says it follows that it is not the case that whatever is a conventional truth is necessarily not a product. All these things with multiple knots in it are naughty. Okay? So what does this mean? It follows that it is not the case that whatever is a conventional truth is necessarily not a product. Okay, so they're just saying, you know, it's not true what you said, that whatever is a conventional truth is necessarily not a product. So no. No, the challenger is saying, is agreeing with the wrong conclusion. Yeah, and the defender says, I accept that it's not the case that whatever is a conventional truth is necessarily not a product. And then the challenger says, it follows that that lack of pervasion that you're talking about does not exist. If it existed, that whatever is a conventional truth is necessarily not a product, then posit something. Okay, so if it exists, posit something that is a conventional truth, and it's also something other than not a product. It is also something that is not a product, something that is a product. Yeah, posit something that is a conventional truth and is a product. Okay, that's what the challenger is saying. What can the defender say to that in this system? Yeah, you know, you win, I'm confused. Okay, so then he comments here, even though the answers, there is no privation and the privation is opposite, may be given only for an argument in which the reason is established, the challenger would not normally attack that implicit assumption by the defender that the reason is established. Okay. In other words, if maybe the reason isn't established, but the defender didn't pick up on it, and so instead they said there's no privation, the challenger wouldn't necessarily at that point come back and say, oh, why are you looking at the pervasion? The first thing you got to check is if there's agreement. Yeah. So the challenger wouldn't do that. The challenger would keep on with the argument and then at a later time come back to that. Okay? So the challenger would not normally attack that implicit assumption by the defender that the reason is established. Thus, that implicit assumption is not treated in the same way as taking the opposite stance when the defender asks why or the reason is not established. Okay? So in other words, if the reason, you know, isn't established and the defender spaces out and doesn't notice it and instead talks about the pervasion, the challenger just ignores it at that point. But if the defender says, oh, there's no agreement, that's something different because there the defender is actually stating a position. And so then the challenger would come back and debate with about that. Mm-hmm. Okay. So thus that implicit assumption is not treated in the same way as taking the opposite stance when the defender answers why or the reason is not established. Because in those cases, the defender's position is explicitly stated. Yeah. In the case of the implicit assumption, the issue of the establishment of the reason would have to come up later in later discourse if it is not an issue, if it is an issue. Okay, so it would just come up. Okay. I highly recommend reading in advance before Thursday night class and not just showing up without having read what we're going to go over, because when we hit difficult material like this, you have to have read it before to at least understand something. Here's another thing I made up. The challenger says, and now we're going to go according to what the Prasangikas believe. Okay. Challenger says, it follows that the realization of emptiness is not essential to attaining awakening because of being a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence. Follows that the realization of emptiness is not essential to attaining awakening because of being a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence. So what do you think about that? What's the first thing you're going to check? Property. Is there property of the subject? Yes. Okay, what's the next thing you check? Pervasion. Is there pervasion? No. Okay, so the defender here says no pervasion. In other words, it's not the case that whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is not essential to attaining awakening. Yeah, that's what the defender says. Okay. So then the challenger can say to that, is it follows that whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is necessarily not essential to attaining awakening. Okay, so he's agreeing with the guy because a common locus, because a common locus of wisdom, consciousness realizing non-inherent existence and not being essential. It should say, it follows that whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is necessarily essential. So giving the person the right idea. The first no privation, in other words, the defender is saying, it's not the case that whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is not essential to attaining awakening. Yeah. Or whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is not necessarily not essential. Yeah. It gets confusing with all the knots.
And then the challenger said, I agree with that because the common locus of wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence.
Yeah. No, the challenger doesn't say, I agree.
Well, you seem to put back and say it follows.
Yeah. It follows doesn't mean I agree. It follows that whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is necessarily essential to attaining awakening because a common locus of a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence. Oh, I think I may have said the wrong thing again. Okay. Even I get confused. Okay. It follows, it follows that whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is necessarily essential to attaining awakening because a common locus of a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence and being not essential to attaining awakening does not exist. It follows that whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence, you have to use some abbreviations in there. Existence is necessarily, it follows that whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is necessarily essential to attaining awakening. Because a common locus of a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence and being not essential to attaining awakening does not exist. So if we go, is there a common locus between that wisdom consciousness and not being essential to attaining an awakening? Is there a common locus? No. Okay. So in other words, it does pervade that whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is necessarily essential to attaining awakening. Okay, so what the challenger did in this instance is they turned around and disproved what the defender had said. Because the defender had said that it's not the case that whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is not essential to attaining awakening. And the challenger said, actually, if you compare those two, there's not something that is both of them.
I thought in this example, the challenger was asserting a wrong conclusion to start with, and the defender had the right answer, and then it was the challenger who was coming around and asserting the right reason.
No, the challenger started out, it follows that the realization of emptiness is not essential to attaining awakening.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they're stating the wrong thing because of being a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence.
Mm-hmm.
And the defender said, no privation.
which is correct. So the challenger was wrong, the defender was correct, and then the challenger comes around to the correct thing, like the defender.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is true. There was no pervasion.
So on this occasion, the defender wins.
Yeah, the defender would win in this one, yeah. I think I worded it wrong somewhere along the line for the example I wanted to give.
This is good because the examples that he gives in the text, it's always the challenger being right and the defender being wrong. So this is good because this gives the other way where we're seeing the defender being right and the challenger being wrong.
Okay. It follows that the realization of emptiness is not essential to attaining awakening. Yeah. Well, the challenger is seeing something wrong to start with. Yeah, and the defender here is just saying no pervasion. It's kind of like in the previous one, the challenger, it follows that the challenger says the subject, uncomposed space, is not a product because of being a conventional truth. That one's correct, isn't it? Okay. So my example isn't really a good example for that one. Yeah, okay, if we say, it follows that the realization of emptiness is essential to attaining awakening, then the challenger is saying something correct. We want the challenger.
The defender is confused, and so they will say no pervasion, and then we prove there is pervasion.
Yeah. Okay, so you're saying at the first, when we talk the challenger, it follows that the realization of emptiness is essential to attaining awakening because of being a wisdom consciousness realizing it. So that's true. That's a correct thing. Okay. Oh, and then the defender says no pervasion. Okay. In other words, that it is not the case that whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is not essential to attaining awakening. Right? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, we have to start out differently.
First example about the colors. Mm-hmm. So it starts out, the defender says, I accept that whatever is a color is necessarily red. Doesn't that imply that the challenger said that previously?
Yeah.
So the challenger could start out by saying something incorrect.
Right.
So they don't necessarily have to start with something correct.
No.
Oh, and that third statement, how the reason is the property of the subject.
Okay, let's start from the beginning. Because the third statement, we're just dealing with
not. But the challenger comes back with a full syllogism.
The challenger comes back with, it follows that whatever is a wisdom consciousness, realizing non-inherent existence, is necessarily essential to attaining awakening. Because a common locus of a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence and being not essential to attaining awakening does not exist. Now, if we start out realizing non-inherent existence is necessarily essential to attaining awakening.
Because there is a locus between the two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
so
there's
then
a
you're
common,
proving the pervasion. Yeah.
There's a common locus of the wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence and being essential to awakening does exist.
But this one's saying it in a more complicated way, which is saying that a common locus of the wisdom realizing non-inherent existence and being not essential to attaining awakening does not exist. Yeah? So there's two different ways you could say it. Yeah, I was trying to copy what the format that he gave here, but the other way makes it more easy to understand.
Actually, I think the way you're saying it makes it a pervasion, where the other way is indefinite, just because a common locus between the two does exist doesn't mean that subject is one of them. But to say that a common locus between a wisdom realizing emptiness and not being essential to awakening does not exist makes it a pervasion, right, where the other is not a pervasion.
Yeah. So you need the complicated way.
How is it that a common locus of a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence and not being essential to awakening does not exist is a property of the subject, the wisdom realizing?
Wait a minute. What are you not understanding? We're making a statement that there's not a common locus between the wisdom realizing non-inherent existence and not being essential.
The subject, wisdom realizing, realizing the non...
No. It follows that whatever is a wisdom consciousness, it has nothing about the subject. It says it follows that whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is necessarily essential to attaining awakening. Okay? Because a common locus of a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence and not being essential to attaining awakening does not exist. So look at what the thing that's being said. Okay, you have, so just start out with, you know, a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence. Okay, does it or does it not have a common locus with not being essential to attaining awakening? No. Okay. So that part's right. Then we go back. It follows that whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is necessarily essential to attaining awakening, because what you said, that there's no common locus between these two, is wrong, because there's nothing now I'm confused. Because a common locus between a wisdom consciousness and not being essential to attaining awakening does not exist. Yeah.
It's just a statement.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or
in that case, I'm good.
It's a consequence.
Yeah, it's a consequence. Okay.
In a consequence, does the subject have to be... Do you have to check with the subject and the reasoning? Does the reason have to be
in this kind of thing, when the reason itself is like an explanation or a pervasion, you first check that. And if that works, then you say there's agreement with the subject. Yeah. Yeah, that's okay. Or I had another way to do it. Okay, the challenger says, it follows that it is not the case that whatever a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent, whatever is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence is not essential to attaining awakening. Okay, and then the defender says, yeah, that's right. I accept that. It's not essential. And then the challenger comes back with the right answers and says, it follows that a lack of pervasion doesn't exist. If it exists, they're asking them to justify their position. If it exists, posits something that is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence that is not essential to attaining awakening. Because when we look back at the original one, it said, okay, the thing was, because of being a wisdom, it follows that the realization of emptiness is not essential to attaining awakening because of being a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence. And the defender said no pervasion to that. If it's a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence, it's not necessarily not essential to attaining awakening. No, we changed the first one, didn't we?
We took out the not.
Yeah, what?
We made the true statement.
Okay, so the first one should read, it follow. What's the first one, the very the top? The
it follows close that the realization of emptiness is essential for awakening.
Okay, yeah, we took out the not there. So that person looked at it and said, oh, there's no pervasion. So another way to come back is to say, you're wrong. You know, if you're right, yeah, then posit something that is a wisdom consciousness realizing non-inherent existence that is not essential to attaining awakening. And the guy can't posit anything. So that may be a simpler way to do it. There's just, you know, showing two different alternatives. Shall we stop here? we have left the one the defender says the privation is opposite, and the defender says, I accept. It might be very good, you know, what Dan suggests in the book is to be with your partner and read these things out like you're actually having a debate, you know, because that way you get familiar with the way that things could go. And I think that's a very good idea.
Could you follow that little debate up with, so that follows that Shakyamuni Buddha has not realized the wisdom realizing emptiness because it is not essential to awakening, and get the defender to give an example of something like that and then see what they come back with.
Give an example to the defender of if what they're saying is right. Do they agree with that? Yeah, that's another way to do it. Okay. So what was... So that one was the challenger then saying it follows...
That Shakyamuni Buddha does not have a wisdom consciousness realizing nor an inherent existence because it's not essential to his awakening. And then the defender will be like, well, no, and then...
A little earlier in here when we were going over the defender's answers and what the challenger says, there's parts where the challenger may say a thesis in a certain... And he said in Tibetan it's understood from the tone of voice or something that...
Yeah.
They're expected to give a reply of the reason, of a reason.
Yeah.
In English, couldn't we just say, like, sound is impermanent because, and then it's obvious that you're asking them to fill in the sentence.
Yeah, you could say it that way, or you could say sound is impermanent, you know, like that. But what Dan is saying is it's much clearer to just say it directly what you want.
So you just say sound is impermanent, supply a reason?
Yeah, something like that. I can't remember exactly where that was. Yeah. Or give a reason. You would say give a reason why sound is impermanent. You know, when you're very proficient with things, you can use all sorts of shortcuts because you know what's implied. But when you're just learning, it's better to be very explicit. Yeah. And I've also learned that when you're explaining something to someone, it's very good to be very explicit. Don't assume anything.